Bitcoin is either going to a million or zero. Everything that can't go to zero can.
The market is always right. You're not.
The people who say, I'm going to buy and hold Bitcoin forever and I'm going to hold nothing else, are the same people who would have invested in Bernie Madoff.
Bitcoin is one of the greatest inventions in all of humanity, wrapped up as a get-rich-quick scheme.
I need the Bitcoin community to stop being such assholes. No one can prove to me that Satoshi is not the CIA, the IDF, MI6, special services in Russia.
Yes, you're right if it was closed source code, but the code is open source. You're showing the whole world. So if there's a back door, it's easy to see where the back door is.
So you're saying
code.
If the CIA wrote it, they screwed themselves over.
Down the rabbit hole. Down. Cypherpunk.
Welcome back to another episode of Cypherpunk, where we explore money's history, crypto's future, and Web3's role in advancing human rights, freedom, and digital liberty. Today's guest is Bob Iacino, a veteran trader, strategist, and co-author of The Unfiltered Investor. He spent over three decades in the trenches of global markets, from the chaos of the CME trading pits to calling moves live on CNBC and Bloomberg. Bob's seen it all: 9/11, 2008, COVID, and now the AI-driven algorithmic markets shaping our future. He's one of the few insiders who walked away from the Wall Street script to tell the truth about how the system really works. Welcome, Bob.
Good to see you, man.
Bobby Ice, as I should say.
Yeah, it's been a long cool time name. Since I've been called that. But
so welcome to the show, my man.
Thanks, man.
Talk to me about how you used to work on the CME trading floor. Sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, that was a cool experience. And it's actually like going back in time and thinking about it now. It was probably the most fun job you could ever have. I mean, I always tell people it's the closest thing to playing sports for a living that a 5'9" Italian guy who's slow could possibly do. You know, it would be screaming and yelling, and a lot of the activity happened between 7:15 and about 11. And then it would slow down unless it was some sort of afternoon event or bond auction or something like that. And it would just be like, you know, 2,000 guys and about 300 women just screaming at each other. It was a very male-dominated pit. Mm. But they would just scream at each other, and there were fist fights and there was throwing things, and then everybody was fine at the end. You know, we'd all get off work at, you know, 3:15, right around there, Chicago time. That was in Chicago. And we'd go across to the bar and have drinks together. Some guys would be bleeding from fights they were in and things like that. Not me, but other people. And it was an experience, man. I miss it and I don't, because it was a very toxic place to work on a human level, but just a lot of fun. I mean, think of it as like your college years or wherever else you were just overly excited and active and indulgent. The pit was like that.
Yeah, you're literally in the pits.
Yeah, you're literally in the pits.
You're in the pits, man.
Yeah, and it was, you know, I don't know, it was just nuts, but it was fun. I wouldn't trade it for anything.
So your family had an Italian bakery in Chicago?
Yeah.
Do they still have it, or what's going on?
So my brother still has it, but it's not a bakery anymore. Mm-hmm. So it was my father bought it in 1977. I was 11 years old. My brother was 13. He immediately went to work there at like 13 years old.
Wow.
There were child labor laws, but it's family. What are you going to do? I started working there about 3 or 4 years later, and we worked in this bakery 6 days a week in the summer. And then, you know, after school, sometimes as we were growing up, and kind of got me this thing where I fell in love with American desserts and started to hate European desserts, because we made European desserts. So the second I started working there, I was eating them like sfogliatelle and, you know, cannoli and all these other things, baba rum, and you know, all these things that Europeans eat and love and brag about, I loved at the time and really can't stand now. Now I just want like a red velvet cupcake, like the most basic thing on the planet. Yeah, and it was great. It expanded and expanded. And then 1 year, my father brought on other partners and they teamed up to vote my father out of the company.
Oh, so really?
We all left.
Oh, my goodness.
And 3 years later, it was closed.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's how I ended up at the exchange, because I planned on working in the family business basically forever. It started out as a small Italian bakery and became an Italian food supply company, supplying restaurants and stores with all kinds of different things, from breads to sweets to some pasta sauces. And then it became my father and my brother went and opened up what in Italy you call a tavolo caldo, which is like a bakery, coffee shop, sandwich shop with hot food as well. They went and opened that. And I went to the exchange, and that's where I broke off from that type of, I still have a love affair with that industry, but It's because I didn't work in it.
My dad said when he went to Italy, he would go to those and you'd walk up and just stand there. And is that kind of what your brother and your dad did?
That's exactly it. No waiters or waitresses. You order something at the counter. You can eat at the counter if you want and go sit down. So my brother still has that in the suburbs of Chicago now. My father passed away in 2016. But yeah, it's
sorry to hear that, brother.
Thank you. I appreciate that. He
sounds
still,
like a really
still
good
missed. He's still
kid.
Missed. Very, very much missed.
How did your brother do during COVID with all the draconian stuff that was going on? Did that really affect his business there and kind of hurt him? And
it did. It very much did. The business was in Illinois and he obviously had to shut it down. But the good thing was all of his employees were behind the counter anyway. So he didn't really lose that many employees. He narrowed down the menu and started doing a lot of takeout and he survived.
Wow.
I don't know if he did a PPP or not. I never asked him.
Yeah.
But he survived and actually ended up thriving coming out of it, which was nice. But,
well, yeah, I mean, a lot of the competition went under. Yeah. You know, family businesses that were there for generations got shut down. That's what
and you know, one of the worst things about it.
Terrible, man.
Yeah, and one of the worst things about it, and one of the things I still get upset about now is that, you know, my brother makes Italian cookies. And he's competing with Walmart's crap Italian cookies.
Yeah.
But Walmart was open.
Yeah, of course. All the big boys could stay open. It's the little guys that got fucked.
Yeah, and my brother was just like, you know, I'm just trying to sell things out of the front door now. And Walmart, they got people, they got cashiers, people walking around. It was really
annoying. I mean, how ridiculous was that? How corrupt was that?
Just evil.
I mean, so
absolutely
so unbelievably stupid, the whole thing. You know, I can't believe they got away with that. And the people who pushed all that forward, I mean, they still are, you know, they've kind of like scuttled off into the... Yeah. Into the fucking bushes and, you know, no accountability. But
only the people at their country club know who they are.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, Florida was, we did different here. We didn't play those games. So when I traveled even a year afterwards and I felt like I was in like a dystopian Netflix TV series. Like, what the hell are you guys doing here? How are you guys letting them do this to you? You know, I just couldn't believe it.
You go to New York and Chicago, and Chicago's where I'm from. You still, every once in a while, see people with a mask on in public.
I see that in the airports. Yeah. I see that all around. I mean, you know, hey, I don't have a problem. I tell everybody like, oh, everybody wear a mask or this, that, and the other. He's not wearing a mask. I said, everybody do what the fuck they want to do.
Yep.
You know, if you want to wear fucking six masks, wear six masks. You know, totally just don't force me to fucking do it.
Totally
Leave me alone. If you don't, it's the same thing with this, with COVID, with the lockdowns and all the stuff. The whole thing was fucking stupid. If you're worried, then you stay home. Mm-hmm. You know, you order Uber Eats or you eat canned food for 6 months. You do that. Let everybody else do what they want, you know? So
it's interesting. COVID is why I'm here, why I live in Florida now.
Wow.
Yeah, because we were in Chicago. My wife worked in a restaurant. She worked in the restaurant industry. So she got furloughed. And I was still going down to the exchange every day. And so my job transitioned to home as much as it could. And so we came down and stayed in Southwest Florida the month of June 2020. And I always tell people when we
left. Welcome to paradise.
Thank you so much. I love it here. We lived in a neighbor. We lived in Chicago. So we bump into a lot of people here from Chicago. And the conversation is always the same. You're from Chicago. Me too. Where? I'm like, Chicago. Like, oh, I'm from like Lake Zurich, which is like 40 miles outside of the city, right? We lived in the city and we used to talk about how we would hear a gunshot a month and they were far away. And if you're familiar with gunfire, you're from Florida, so you've heard it. If you know what gunfire sounds like, you know what it sounds like and you know it's far away or close and it's not worrisome at all.
Yeah.
When we got back after the month in Florida, we got back to Chicago, it was a gunshot a week and they were close.
Wow.
And one day my wife walked our two dogs in the park across the street from our house in a neighborhood called Pilsen where we lived. And she came back and she's like, is this what I think it is? And it was a 9mm shell casing.
Oh my God.
Yeah. She's like, can we leave?
I'm
like,
yeah, that's crazy. That's, you know, our you know, the producer of this podcast is behind the mic over there. He literally left LA for the same reasons. Like, you know, it was like during COVID and he took his kids to the park. He took his kid to the park and like, there's just drug addicts everywhere in the park.
Crazy.
And like, they're in the slides and they're in the jungle gyms and they're on the benches. And like, he's trying to play with his kid in the park outside in the sun. And a police officer comes to him and says, hey, you need to leave, sir. You can't be here. We're going to arrest you. He says, well, look about the guy doing meth over there. And the guy fucking
laugh. But
I mean, it was so absurd. He's like, no, they're fine here. You're not. And
it's funny.
I think he just, you know, that was like the last straw. Was
I lived
crazy.
In Pacific Palisades, California for 4.5 years. And my old house burned to the ground during those fires. When was that last year? I don't even know. But so I've lived in Chicago, New York for 6 months, Los Angeles County, California, and then here. This is by far the best place I've lived. And I was actually talking to Tommy DeLongo, who you spoke to a couple weeks ago.
He's Tom's awesome, man. Character.
And yeah, we were talking and I'm like, dude, I'm going to die here. Like if everything goes to shit and I have to put my back against the wall and shoot at people coming at me in Florida, this is where it's going to happen. I'm not going anywhere else.
Mm, I love it.
Yeah.
Well, we're glad to have you here, brother.
Thanks, man. It's good to see you.
Tom's so passionate. All of his,
God, I love him.
You know, a lot of his people who watch his podcast, they were commenting like, you know, hey, don't interrupt Tom. Don't interrupt Tom. My bad, guys. I'm sorry. I apologize. I got it. I'm still pretty new at this, you know, so yeah. Give me a break, you know, but I'll try to do a better job of mm-hmm. that today when I'm interviewing you.
You can interrupt me all you want. I don't interrupt Tom either. So,
well, I actually had some questions for Tom, and it was like we talked for like 3 hours, yeah. And like I still hadn't asked the first question on my thing. Yeah. So that was just kind of funny, but yeah, it was a great conversation, and we're having a good conversation here too. So I want to ask you about the story I thought was pretty cool. When you were trading early on, you made a $70,000 trading error.
Yeah,
and you walked in, and your boss was going to fire you, but you just like owned it, and like he just didn't fire you. So tell me about that.
So this story goes to my love for dogs and my desire to take personal responsibility for pretty much everything. Not everything, I guess, but mm-hmm. pretty much everything.
We all struggle with that.
Yeah. So I, you know, it was early on in my career and I was allowed to kind of man the desk by myself where mm-hmm. the senior guys for me left and I was down on the floor by myself. And I took an order from somebody and I did the order backwards. So I don't remember the exact situation, but I bought instead of sold, let's say, for example. Mm-hmm. And because I was so smart, I'm doing air quotes right now. I just don't like to actually physically do them. Because I was so smart, I thought, well, I know I did this backwards, but I'm just going to hang on to this trade because I know it's going to kind of go my way. So I did the customer's order and I'm like, I'm going to hang on to this one and then I'm going to get out at profit and I'm going to be mm-hmm. a hero, right? Mm-hmm. Well, inevitably, every time you do that in a trade, it goes the other way. So I finally covered the trade when it was $70,000 underwater. It was like $69,000 and change. So I went upstairs to my boss. I told him what happened. And I said, he goes, what am I supposed to do about this? I said, I honestly think you should fire me. He goes, well, just go home. So I left and I went home. And I'm like, that's it. I had my dream job. Mm-hmm. It's over. You know, I screwed it up. I'm like an NFL kicker that just, you know, lost the game too many times and I'm done. I'm going to go bag groceries. So I had a German Shepherd dog at the time. And she was just regal, like just full fur around her neck. She looked like a lion. She mm-hmm. was huge. And I took her to a park in Chicago near my house, and I was just throwing this Kong toy as far as I could throw it, mm-hmm. just trying to get my frustration out. And I'm mm-hmm. watching her run. And this is the kind of dog that could like leap a park bench, but her back never moved. She mm-hmm. was like a hurdler yeah. over park benches. Just beautiful. And I'm throwing it in a sort of robotic fashion. And she comes back, she brings me the Kong, and for some reason I look at her, and her tail is hitting her on each side of her body. She's wagging her tail so hard. Mm-hmm. And I looked up, and it's a beautiful day. It's like 65 degrees. It's sunny, and I'm like,
no gunshots.
It's just money. No gunshots, thank God. I'm like, it's just money. Like, you know, who cares? Look how happy this dog is just to chase a fucking toy, right? What's wrong with me? Like, what am I doing? Why am I so upset about this? So the next day I walk in and I said, he goes, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm here to collect my stuff. I assume I'm fired. And I said, do me a favor. If you're not firing me, just give me an okay reference past this point, up into this error. And every cent I make will go back to paying that error wherever I work. I will pay you back. Doesn't matter where I work. I'll give you the money back. And he shook his head and he goes, shut the fuck up. Go down to your desk. I went down to my desk and that's it. And I credit the dog for that. Yeah, I credit the dog for that, not for anything else.
Mm. I had one of our executives, we were doing a credit line or something and it was all scammed. And he did the same exact thing, lost 50 to 70K this past year. Yeah.
So it happens.
I didn't fire him, but gave him some shit.
Oh, good for you.
So that's why I latched on to that story. It was a cool one. So what made you finally say you're done? You know, working on the floor.
Well, it was two things. Number one, being cold mm-hmm. and wanting to leave Chicago after COVID. I mean, the floor kind of slowly disintegrated, but I left the floor in 2004 while there was still business down there. And I remember thinking to myself, you ever hear the phrase golden handcuffs? mm-hmm. you're basically stuck because you're yeah. still making enough money mm-hmm. and you can't duplicate that money outside yeah. of work, but you're making less than you used to. And that's mm-hmm. the situation we were in. I'm like, still making a lot more money than most people, mm-hmm. but I'm not making as much as I used to, and I can see the trajectory. And in the midst of that trajectory, 9/11 happened. So all of a sudden, I went from a downward slope to a huge spike in revenue wow. because over 3,000 people died. And that felt awful. You yeah. know, I mean, I took the money, don't get me mm-hmm. wrong, but it just felt bad. Mm-hmm. So one day I just said, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. If I'm going to transition, I got to transition now. So I transitioned off the floor. I moved with my former wife to Los Angeles. That's when we left. Mm-hmm. And decided I needed to retrain myself to do things from off the trading floor. And it's a weird transition, but for me, it was like, this is the only time I could really do it. If I wait too long, I'm not going to be able to do it because I'm not going to have that time in between. So I gave my business to my partner and I left.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Interesting. I always want to talk to somebody on the floor about, did you ever hear how Hillary Clinton was like a corn futures trader or whatever? Yeah. And she had like a 98% win rate. What do you know about that?
I know that it was extended insider trading. It's the same as the Pelosi stuff, only yeah. way worse. Way worse.
Yeah, it was like statistically impossible. She had like a 98% hit rate or something. Just yeah, I mean, crazy. Look,
there were things that happened on the trading floor from trader to trader that, you know, were borderline. Not they were illegal. I was going to say they were borderline illegal, but they weren't. Yeah. They were illegal. I think yeah. we're past the statute of limitations. Besides, none of them included me. None of them. But, you know, there were under the table deals left and right. As a matter of fact, I remember one of the brokers. So there were brokers, there were desk brokers, there were traders, and everybody made money off of each mm-hmm. other. So if you had a relationship with a broker, he was making money off you, you were making money off him. And one year, this one broker invited me to his Christmas party at his house, and he lifted the garage up and mm-hmm. he turned to all his guests. He goes, pick one. There's snowmobiles in there, motorcycles, flat screen TVs. Just like pick one, right? There was all kinds of deals like that down wow. on the trading floor. And Hillary Clinton's stuff was like, it was gifts. I remember every year on your birthday, there's a thing at the CME called the Members Club, mm-hmm. right? And if everybody knew when your birthday was, you'd be having coffee in the Members Club and everybody would come up and give you a trading card with a trade on it. It's like, what's this? He goes, after the open, sell this wherever you want. That's your gift.
Oh, wow.
So you basically got money, but it was through trading cards.
Oh, wow. That's yeah. interesting.
So it was.
That's pretty cool.
I guess it was laundered. I guess that's what it was, right?
Pretty wild.
Gift. Yeah.
Pretty wild.
So
it's pretty wild. So how did you start the Unfiltered Investor?
It was a number of things. So we do a podcast as well, right? Mm-hmm. And the podcast is growing, and it's growing at a rate we didn't expect it to grow. And we had people constantly asking us, do you manage money? No, I managed money before, hated it. Mm-hmm. Is there any way I can follow your trades? Well, no. Do you educate other traders? I mean, I used to, I hated that too, for reasons mm-hmm. we can get into, but I didn't like any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. So I met with my partner in a company I own called Path Trading Partners. You know, him and I started it and we still have it. And my co-host, Jim Iorio, we decided, you know, we need to kind of give these people a way to get that satisfaction. We call out a lot of things at our show. Mm-hmm. We're like, yeah, like, for example, November 2023, we agreed that gold was the best trade going forward, mm-hmm. right? It's worked out. We got a lot of requests to follow our trades after that, mm-hmm. But we don't do that. So we said, you know what? We'll create a newsletter. We'll mm-hmm. tailor it around who we think the audience is going to be, and we'll sell it. And we'll make money off of it, and people can buy it or not buy it. Doesn't mm-hmm. really matter. We'll give a discount to the people who watch our show, mm-hmm. and that'll be that. And that's how it started. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's fairly in depth. I mean, it's anywhere from 16 to 21 pages every week. We put it out every Sunday.
I think you guys said that the market's breaking from reality. What do you mean by that?
So there's something called the CapEx PE ratio, right? The CAPE. It's cyclically adjusted price to earnings ratio. It was developed by Robert Shiller, the same guy who did the Case-Shiller Home Index, right? There's only been one other time he took the data all the way back to, I think, 1912. There's only been one other time that the KP ratio has been this high, and it was 1999, 2000. Now, it's lower now than it was then, and mm-hmm. I'm also not predicting that necessarily. Yeah. But things are really, really expensive. Now, if you listen to other people, and I do listen to them, names excluded, the entire dynamic of the stock market is different. Therefore, it justifies this type of PE ratio. But to me, at the end of the day, there has to be value in owning a stock. There has to be value in owning a currency, owning a commodity. The value has to be there, or eventually people are going to sell it. You know, a company can make all the money in the world, but if people aren't buying their stock, the stock's not going to go up. So it's detached from where it should be when you count all of the unknowns in the overall economy right now. We don't know what tariffs are going to do. I like tariffs personally. I do. But they go against my heart and soul of just open market capitalism. Mm-hmm. They do. When you see the tariffs starting to adjust our debt to GDP ratio lower, which hasn't been the case since pre-COVID, because they're now calculating the tariffs. Mm-hmm. The tariffs are being paid currently, at least partially, by other companies and by corporations. People are starting to feel it a little bit in export prices, but overall export prices have not gone up.
Yeah.
So that means the tariffs are getting paid without the price to the consumer going up.
Kind of surprising, honestly.
It's very surprising. And that means the consumer's not going to pay for it. If you go back to Trump's first set of tariffs in 2017, the steel tariffs, for example, steel prices briefly rose and then leveled off. Mm. It was not inflation. It was a one-time increase in prices.
Yeah, I think that's what they said. Bessent and Trump and those guys kind of said that, hey, yeah, this is what happened last time. My friend Craig Shapiro says that Trump's putting pressure on all these guys. He says he's doing Don Mafia.
100%.
He's a mafia boss on these guys.
100%.
He said, but that only works until it works. So
yeah,
I mean, I don't know. I mean, we'll see. I mean, I think a 5 to 10 to 15%, like if you stay in that range with the tariffs, I mean, I think it's just like, you know, like a sales tax almost. It's like the cost of doing business in the United States.
That's one of those things. If it's a one-time price increase, yeah, we'll bitch and then we'll get used to it. Right.
You look, I mean, at after what they printed all the money. I mean, look, everything went up. So
that's a whole nother thing. I mean, yeah, if they keep doing that, we're eventually doomed anyway as an economy. But yeah, when you look at it from a perspective of what happened during the Biden administration, and I don't blame all of that on Biden. I blame it on the Fed. I blame pretty much everything in life on the Fed. But if you look at that inflationary pop that we had, upwards of 9%, if you look at CPI, I don't personally think CPI is a good measure, but whatever. We've now leveled off at that level. If you look, the CPI is an index, and what we get every month when the data comes out, when the government's open, is an adjustment of that particular index. Did it go up or did it go down? But you look at the chart of the CPI index, it goes like this. It never goes down except in recessions. So if you want inflation to pull back, you want a recession. That's all you're calling for when you're saying, I need inflation to drop. You know, I want deflation. If you want deflation, you want a recession in our current environment. That's what happens. And that's fine. These adjustments, in my view, are needed. But prices went up 9% and they're still at that level and slightly higher. And we're just starting to get used to it. Mm-hmm. That's what happens over time because of the money printing and everything else. Mm-hmm. So people are used to that kind of thing. So if inflation's at 2%, I mean, we have a Fed that says our target is 2% a year. All of your goods and services need to go up 2% a year. I'm like, fucking why?
Yeah.
Like, why do I need to pay more for things?
That's pretty every much year? The Bitcoiner's argument, right?
And it's because they rely on asset inflation to make things, rather than price inflation, to make things look valuable when you print money.
Yeah.
It's not more valuable. It just costs more.
Yeah. They're just playing, you know, accounting games, really, at the end of the day, you know, and then slowly shuttling people into higher tax rates and shit. 100%. I mean, it's pretty insidious how they do it over time. I think John Maynard Keynes said that he wanted the animal spirits, you know, and then I think Friedrich Hayek was blocking on Hayek's name. Yeah. I think Hayek responded and said that, why do we want this? You know, why do we want to make everything more expensive?
Yeah.
And I think that Keynes said that in the long run, you know, or Hayek said, what about the long run? And then Keynes said, in the long run, we're all dead. That was made me laugh. So it's kind of like this thing, like basically who cares about the future, right? Yeah. Who cares about the consequences you're passing on?
Right.
So it was just kind of this micro shot into, the Keynesian philosophy of money printing. And, you know, obviously we saw what happened with the massive money print that just occurred. We saw how people that were politically connected got the money first and how they went out and bought single family homes and did all this shit.
I feel like the Keynesians will do the same thing that the people sort of schlep for communism and socialism. It's never really been tried correctly.
Yeah.
That's what they'll say.
Yep.
The Keynesian should be, you know, relegated to the dustbin of history at this point. It is a massive failure in my view.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Well, they didn't do it right. That's what they'll say.
Yeah. You know, and luckily we've had somewhat free markets and enabled capitalism to flourish. It's flourished despite all these things.
Flourished in Florida.
Yeah, especially in Florida. I mean, we're flourishing very well here.
Yeah.
What do you think about Bitcoin? So is Bitcoin a new idea to you?
So that's an interesting question. Is it a new idea to me?
Like from a trading perspective, obviously you've traded multiple different things.
I've traded Bitcoin. I've traded Bitcoin a lot. I've held it for periods of time. Mm-hmm. I have not held it long-term yet. For me, it's very difficult for me to let go of the idea that when I make 300 and 400% on something, I'm supposed to expect to make more.
Yeah.
That's difficult for me to shake off, right? The last Bitcoin trade I did, I made 300% on it. I mean, thank you. And that's that to me. You know, that's the way I look at it. I'm not a technologist by any stretch. You know, I started in the market drawing charts on graph paper. That was the first assignment my first boss gave me when I was in the markets. He's like, I need you to draw graphs. I'm like, don't we have computers now? I'm just getting an email. So can't we do that on the computer? He goes, yeah, we can do it on the computer, but you need to learn what every line means. So I drew it on a graph. So when people talk to me about mining and nodes and 30,000 foot, I get what you're saying. Okay. Blockchain, I get why it's theoretically safe. But I'm a little bit in the DeLongo camp where I say this is not the end of technology, and therefore this idea that it's impenetrable scares me. Look at it from this perspective. I got a guy so mad at me when I said this on a show the other day. The people who say I'm going to buy and hold Bitcoin forever and I'm going to hold nothing else are the same people who would have invested in Bernie Madoff. Now, the reason the guy got mad at me is he thought I was calling Bitcoin a Ponzi scheme. Like, man, I'm not. Mm-hmm. I don't know enough about it to know if it is. From the description that people who call it a Ponzi scheme give, everything's a Ponzi scheme. Well, it's only the new buyers that are making the other people money. It's the same thing if I buy Apple.
Yeah.
The new buyers of the stock are making me money. That's no different. Well, Apple has a product. Yeah, but so what? If nobody buys the stock, I don't make money. I'm not selling iPhones, right? So I don't see it as a Ponzi scheme, but I see it as, it's just like when the bullish sentiment gets too strong in the equity markets, I start to buy protection. I start to buy puts, right? Because it just does, nothing goes straight up and never stops. Now, I'm expecting a counterpoint from you, and I hope I get it.
Yeah, you will. You'll get a lot of it.
Idea that it can never break and never go down, to me, is fantasy land.
No, I mean, I think it has gone down, you know, over time, if what goes up must come down. I mean, I just think that to truly look at a Bitcoin chart, you know, you are looking at, you know, a 15, 17 year chart of Bitcoin, and it literally breaks people's brains because people are used to thinking linearly, like you're talking about drawing graphs, but Bitcoin has moved as a logarithmic asset. So, you know, it's gone up thousands of percent where it's like, if I drew a graph, it would go from here to the top of the building, right? And then come back down halfway, 50% crash, and then go up to the moon, right? And then, so first off, you are right in the sense that there are different segments of people, right? There's these Bitcoin maximalist people who think Bitcoin is the only thing you should ever own. Yeah. I am not a Bitcoin maximalist. I think, you know, yes, Bitcoin has outperformed everything. Bitcoin is incredibly important, but there are other things you should own, obviously, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But Bitcoin is not just a technology. So a lot of people think like, okay, it's a technology, but it's also a monetary object. It has this monetary history built into the protocol itself. So if you study the history of money and look at these different things, you know, it's not just a technology. It's also this digitally sound hard money that's very similar to gold in a lot of ways. It behaves very similarly to gold. It just improves upon a lot of gold's flaws. So with gold, right, it's very hard to divide gold into little pieces if you want to use it, which ultimately was one of the reasons gold centralized to banks in different places where people would issue receipts off of it, right? Paper money that we use is much more It's much more divisible, and you know, it's easier for people to use. It's easier for people to verify. They can see the stamp on it, and they can accept it, and they know it. Right? With gold, it's like, okay, how do I know that's really a little gram of gold? How do I really know? Right?
Yeah.
I have to assay it. I have to verify it. With Bitcoin, that's all done via a technology called the blockchain. Right? So you can, anybody can verify it. Anybody can assay it, and the code that's built around it, you know, is literally live. People can view it. It's transparent. It's open source, right? So it can be stress tested. And so far, for the past 15 to 17 years, the Bitcoin network has behaved exactly as it was designed and programmed to do, you know, for the past 17 years without any issue or flaw, right?
But to me, 17 years is a blink.
For sure. It's I mean, you know, you're really looking
at, I mean, we've had 17-year bull markets in the end.
I know, right?
So, and this is what it brings it back. When people say that it's a digital hard asset, that breaks my brain.
So yeah, that was the, so Satoshi, that does break your brain, right?
Yeah,
because you
does.
Think of like, hey, I send a picture to you. Mm-hmm. You can easily copy that picture and send it, right?
Right.
But that was like part of the breakthrough of why Satoshi was such a genius in what he created. He created this absolutely scarce asset that you couldn't double spend. It was called the double spend problem.
Mm-hmm.
Like if I sent you Bitcoin, how could I verify that you, you know, couldn't send it to him and him at the same time, right? This true digital, this idea of digital scarcity.
Mm-hmm.
And he used something called the Byzantine General's problem to solve this problem. And essentially the way it works is like, I use the analogy of a poker table.
Mm-hmm.
So people are sitting at a poker table. If we're playing and, you know, somebody wins the pot, like you can't just reach your hand in and take all the money from the pot, right? Why can't you do that?
Because everybody else is there.
There you go.
I mean,
everyone's looking at you and saying, you know, hey, what the fuck are you doing? Why?
Believe it or not, and sorry to interrupt you, but
It
was the same way in the trading pit. So you could actually be a shitty human being in the pit and snake trades and steal a couple here and there and argue about trades you didn't really do. And but then nobody would trade with you.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it was self-policing.
Exactly.
Right? But it went away.
Mm.
So this is kind of my point, is that Bitcoin is the best technology for what you're talking about now. Down the road, things we can't imagine could replace it. And people have this idea that Bitcoin is going to solve every problem and there will never be a problem again. And that's the issue I have with it.
Yeah, I don't think Bitcoin solves every problem. I think it just solves the money problem, right? Which is this idea of having a digitally sound, hard money that you can't steal from people, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like it uses public and private keys, kind of like a username and password.
But it's been stolen, just not directly.
It would be like it would be like you having gold, and then you know you tell somebody where you buried it, and they go steal it, right?
Agree.
The same way that you know I could steal your Bitcoin if you give me the password to your account,
right?
You know?
No, I agree. And so that's we have to clarify: it can be stolen.
It can be stolen from people, yes, just like any other true digital bearer asset, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's like with any bearer asset that you have custody of, it can be stolen if you don't. You know,
so
let me
ask you a technical question.
Yeah, yeah. Ask
if me. Let's say that I'm. So I'm 59 years old, right?
Mm-hmm.
I know I look great. We can get past that. If I had a key, I'm not going to remember it, obviously. Mm-hmm. So I have to keep it somewhere.
Correct.
I don't want to keep it digitally because then that can be found.
Yeah.
Now, a cousin comes over, sees where I wrote it or whatever, steals it, steals my Bitcoin, takes my hard wallet, my cold wallet, whatever, and steals it.
Uh-huh.
It cannot be tracked from me to him in terms of the theft anymore, right? In other words, he has it now.
He has it now, yeah.
And I can't get it back from him unless I could somehow prove through cameras or whatever.
Well, no, you could actually.
But on the blockchain, I can't prove that this particular person took my key.
Yes and no.
Okay,
if he transfers it to his custodial wallet to sell the Bitcoin on his Coinbase account, you can follow. And there are companies that kind of do this analytics now.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to, you know, say, hey, look, I can see it went to here to a Coinbase account. You file a police report, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he sent it stupidly to his Coinbase account with his KYC AML name attached to it, like a brokerage desk or whatever, and sold it there, you could prove that he stole it from you and did that.
But so, is there a functionality to prove that that was mine in the first place?
No, there would be no functionality unless, you know, you have proof of where you bought it.
Because of the anonymity.
Yeah, like it would be like if you go to the gold store and you had a receipt that you bought 5 bars of gold, and then, you know, you invited your cousin over to the house, and then all of a sudden your gold goes missing, right? You know, you'd have the proof that, hey, I bought the gold. They found it at his house. You called the police. They found him with the gold. Here's the proof. Here's my bars, you know. So in the same way, yes, you'd have that level of proof, right? So, but yes, the idea of a true bearer asset is that you have full self-custody and there's no third party that allows you to do anything with your money, right? So I think this is a, historically, through civilization, this is a huge problem. And I think Bitcoin solves that problem. It's not, yes, there's a technological element behind it that Satoshi invented and used. That technology is incredibly sound because it's cryptography and mathematics and code and computer science. You know, that problem is solved, but you know, the idea of Bitcoin as, you know, being able to do all these different things, it is literally hard money in the digital age. It's the first discovery of this concept of absolute scarcity, right? So gold, the reason gold has historically been such a great money is because of its characteristics, right? Its fundamental characteristics. It's not just because somebody randomly decided, hey, we're going to use this rock. It's because gold historically was not able to be printed as fast as other commodities, right? It was like, it has this idea of this, it has this stock to flow. So like, even no matter how much demand there is for gold, historically, only roughly 2% a year has been able to be extracted from the ground to increase that supply and inflate that supply. So that's acted as a constraint, which protects people's purchasing power. So Satoshi took a lot of these ideas and studied monetary history and different characteristics of money, and he built this into a protocol for money on the internet. The same way we have messaging on the internet, right? Like the same way we can send money, or the same way we can send a text message from here to Hong Kong and it can get there in a split second using the internet. You know, we can send information. Now we can send money the same way. We can secure money the same way. And it takes away the ability for governments, whether there's a war or whatever, right, to go in and like Hitler did in World War II, to go in and attack Poland, these different countries. And what did he go for? He went for the fucking gold reserves, right?
So here's where I get lost in this.
Yeah.
There is this idea that the government is not going to be able to take digital assets. And I just don't agree. I think they may be able to do it already now. I couldn't tell you how. What I'm asking people in the Bitcoin world to solve for me is a problem that hasn't occurred yet.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's possible to do that. And that's why this idea that it's secure, it can't be fill in the blank, it solves fill in the blank. There's problems that come into the monetary system. The gold standard not being good was created in 1971. The gold standard worked.
Well, it worked until governments were able
until
to
until governments were able to
and that's
do
what,
it,
that
right?
was the ultimate problem.
That they will have that as a target with crypto. They will. Now, whether they're able to do it now or later is not a thing. Now, one of the problems you have with gold is what you just said. How do I know that's a gram of gold? How do I know that's a gold bar? There's been plenty of evidence of people drilling out, you know, half of the bar and filling it with lead, getting the weight right, covering the outside, and then you drill into the gold bar and it's not solid gold. You know, that's one of the big problems with owning gold. I own a lot of gold. Try and take it from me. It's going to be very difficult. I have dogs. I have guns. Mm-hmm. My wife is better at guns than I am. Yeah. It's going to be difficult to steal.
I mean, they have done that before with, you know, what's his name? FDR did that, right? The Great Depression. They made gold ownership illegal.
Yeah, that's, they don't know where I have it. So, but that means I can't spend it, right? If it's illegal for me to have it, that means I can't spend it. This brings me to problem number two. If for some reason governments colluded, you know, they never do that, right? Colluded and said, Bitcoin's now illegal, period. Now we could say, well, I'll transact with you, but that's the same way that people, that's black market. And that's the same way we've been doing it with gold and cash for years, is the black market. You used to be able to build relationships. If I bought my neighbor's used grill, and I just gave him cash and he gave me the grill and that was that. You can do that with Bitcoin.
Of course,
right? You can just transfer Bitcoin to him. But at the end of the day, people say Bitcoin is not, fiat has no bearing on Bitcoin. But right now, what is Bitcoin's value? $111,000.
It's still denominated in fiat.
There has to be a time, and that time is not yet, where products are priced in Bitcoin.
Correct.
Otherwise, this whole experiment is fun. And it's made a lot of people a lot of money, but it's made them dollars.
Yeah. So, I mean,
and that's one of my issues.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the characteristics of money is acceptability, right? And that's the one thing, that's the one characteristic that Bitcoin is lacking on compared to other monies, right? I mean, if you look at
compared to something like gold,
even dollars, even fiat currencies, right? The acceptability is much higher. But I mean, that's not something, that's the only thing that can solve that is time. As an asset gets,
you need all of us to die.
Well, I mean, when that's going to happen, that is going to happen. The older generations, you know, the millennials over the next 10 years to 20 years are, you know, inheriting wealth from, you know, the older generation. So there's going to be that transition of capital to the younger generations. And, you know, what do you think we're going to buy, gold or Bitcoin? It's going to be Bitcoin.
Well, I say that at this point. So again, I'm 59 years old. I expect to live 20, 30 more years.
Yeah.
I don't know if Bitcoin will be perfect in 20 or 30 years. It may not.
So I would say Bitcoin is already perfect. It does exactly what it's intended to do.
That's just
to
fair.
This absolutely scarce hard money that nobody can print.
That that's fair, print. But we don't know where the cracks are in Bitcoin simply because they don't exist now.
What do you, when you say they don't exist now, what do you,
there's no one can point to a crack in the network or crack in the, I mean, the network itself is not impervious, right? But even if it goes down, you don't lose your money.
Yes, correct.
But your money is,
but the idea is, since it's an open source network, if there was a crack in that network, there's a huge financial incentive for that network to be cracked, for somebody to crack that network and take that Bitcoin.
Sure.
Right. So when you say, I'm not sure about some of these things, the counter argument would be, this is cryptography and mathematics. Mm-hmm. That is the mathematical proof and the cryptographic proof that this network is sound and works well and is impervious from hack attack, because the code itself is open source, meaning that an attacker has, it would be like sharing, it would be like, you've got trillions of dollars sitting in this pot. It's completely transparent. Anybody go take it, right? And every day that Bitcoin exists, every minute that Bitcoin operates, every minute that, you know, millions of people all over the world are using this network, transacting on this network all over the world, billions of people on the planet. Half the planet doesn't even have access to the banking system.
Right.
So, so like, there's a huge pot of money there. If somebody can attack it, nobody just has yet over 17 years.
Right.
And the best cryptographers, the best coders, the best, you know,
haven't done it yet.
Have basically said, we've examined this system. I think I can't remember what book it was. It might have been, there was an intro to the book about how one of the early, I think it was Peter Thiel, paid one of the best hackers in the world to go after the system and try to attack it.
It was Thiel.
And I don't remember what the book was exactly, but it's a classic.
But I remember the story.
You remember the story, yeah. So he paid this guy, and basically the guy was like, this is unbelievable. You know, this is an unbelievably sound system. And, you know, Satoshi thought through every little detail. The guy, I think he will win a Nobel Peace Prize eventually, because he's a brilliant, or an economics prize at least, brilliant design, tested, you know, publicly for almost two decades now. Yeah. And, you know, the system has continued to work as intended.
So I'll throw two points onto that.
Yeah.
Go for one.
The book was called Zero to One.
That's it. Zero to One. That was the book. Number one, again, we're saying the best hackers and cryptographers now.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody climbed Mount Everest the first time,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's what bothers me when I hear Bitcoin people say. A mutual friend of ours said that sometimes they have a Bitcoin meetup at a restaurant that takes Bitcoin and nobody wants to spend it.
Yeah.
That's the silliest thing in the world to me if it's money.
Mm. So
it's a hamburger, guys.
So I know. I mean, I personally will buy a burger at Steak and Shake.
I'm just saying, like, it's a free burger, depending on where you bought. Well, for pretty much everyone now, it's a free burger unless you bought Bitcoin today, right? It's a free burger. Buy the burger. If you're not using any of it as a currency, then it's not a currency.
My friend CJ would say there's a difference between money and currency.
Mm-hmm.
So he makes that distinction and says fiat money is designed to go down in value over time.
Mm-hmm.
That's currency. Bitcoin is money. Gold is money. That's
so what do you
says.
Use money for? Story. Let's say there's no more currency.
So, I mean, well, you can use it to transact if you so choose, right? You can absolutely do that. You can use the Lightning Network. Those tools are being built out on Bitcoin right now. Yeah, another cryptographic network.
I'm aware of the Lightning
Network. Yeah. So you can if you want. It just doesn't mean you have to. Mm-hmm. You know, it gives you the ability, right? So right now the average person works for, you know, the average person works for 20 years and saves their money.
Mm-hmm.
Do the math on 2% inflation over 20 years if they put that.
Yeah, no, it's ridiculous. That's part of my.
They've lost 90% of their purchasing power over that 10 years. So they basically got stolen from by the government and they had no idea, right? Which is what you learn. That's what they teach you at school or whatever. You know, put some money in the savings account, let it sit there and you fucking get debased and stolen from, right? So, you know, the store of value concept of Bitcoin, this idea of absolute scarcity, this money that literally has a hard cap supply. You can divide it, 0.00, you can. 100 million subunits you can divide it into, right? Each Bitcoin. But you know that the inflation rate, the way the system operates, is set in mathematical certainty. Nobody can manipulate that. Nobody can change that. Nobody benefits from inside information. You know, nobody gets to benefit when the Fed decides, hey, we're going to print $5 trillion and inflate the money supply by 50% in 12 months. You know, the people that are connected to that money spigot can benefit from that. That doesn't happen with Bitcoin, right? It's a fully transparent auditable system that people can use. So this idea of being able to store your life's energy, you work hard for your money, to be able to not be forced to have to invest that in the Keynesian rat race, right? Mm-hmm. You can if you so choose, if you find value in something that you want to, but the ability to be able to actually have savings, to save, to feel secure in that savings. I think it's a I think it just changes the way society operates and people operates. I think it shapes human behavior in ways that people, we haven't even begun to unpack. You know, it just, it creates a different incentive mechanism. Right now, the incentive mechanism is, you know, animal spirits and spend, and consumerism, spend.
Everybody's been conditioned and think they have to make more because things are going to cost more.
There you go. Right. So it just changes the way humans behave. It's a, you know, and it's disgusting in some ways, right? If you really think about it, you know, I watch my wife spend money on all sorts of frivolous shit, toys and stuff. It's like, what are we doing? What is this? You know what I mean? But it's been baked into us. It's hardwired into our brains in a lot of ways. So the ability to store your life's energy, you work for something, you get this money, and be able to put it in something that you have mathematical and cryptographic certainty in, that you know is not going to get debased. You know exactly what the inflation rate, you know that it's going to continue to gain value over time because everyone else is going to continue to learn and wake up to that. I think that's a powerful thing.
That part's an if, not a no.
Yeah.
That is an if.
So I would, you know how, we know what the famous quote is. Previous results don't mean future results.
Past results.
Right? Yeah. So they still guide behavior. And they still, you know, you can use 100%. That as reference. Right?
That was one of my biggest complaints when I managed money is that, you know, I had I was a chief investment officer at a fund of funds. We had a 10-year track record. The first 9 years, we never lost money. Mm-hmm. Now, our biggest year was 11%. It was set up to be more bond-like, right? The regulators would not let us use our track record because we didn't have a down year, and therefore it implied that we couldn't lose money. Mm-hmm. They let Madoff do whatever the fuck he wanted, but we couldn't give our actual track record, right?
Yeah.
So we lost 56 basis points.
I mean, that's just crazy.
On purpose.
That's crazy. That's
insane. So that we could lose. That's absurd. So that we'd actually use it. So
those are fiat gains.
That kind of stuff, I'm with you 100%.
So I'm just saying, like, if you look at Bitcoin's chart, I mean, Paul, pull it up for us. Pull up CoinGecko or whatever. Pull up Bitcoin chart. You know, we're talking about the best performing asset in all of human history over a span of
not risk adjusted.
What do you say?
Well, hang on. From start to finish yet. Risk adjusted returns, say, from 2023, right? Gold is up somewhere in the 140% range. Bitcoin is up somewhere in the 200% range. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Bitcoin outperformed. Mm-hmm. But the volatility of Bitcoin was much higher.
Correct. I mean, I'm not debating the volatility aspect.
If you did risk-adjusted return, gold was a better overall return. Yeah. Risk-adjusted return doesn't mean a lot to most people.
Yeah.
They sit there and they go, well, Bitcoin was up 6% today and gold was up 4%, so Bitcoin's better. Mm-hmm. Yes and no. Right. Not in sort of investing theory where you want to protect your capital, because as you know, if I have $100 in my pocket and I give you 50, I now have to make 100% to have $100 again. Mm-hmm. So protecting your capital is much more important than the money you make on your capital, all else equal.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a strong believer that both should have a place in your portfolio. I just think
I know. And I'm talking to you as if you're a maximalist. Yeah. You said in the beginning you're not, but that's because I want to have this conversation, because one of my biggest problems with the Bitcoin community, I'm treating it as a, you know,
it really is a religion. It's a religion. I mean, you're not wrong there. It is a religion.
If I question something, the response I usually get is, okay, boomer. Yeah. Stick with your goal.
I think you're just stuck. I think that's just part of the
question.
Yeah, I think it's just X is very much like that. There's a lot of vocal toxic minority of people.
I don't think Bitcoiners should be insecure about their asset. I think they should have conversations.
I think we're having right now. I think it's a great conversation.
And what they do instead is they go, okay, first of all, I'm not a boomer. Mm-hmm. I'm 2 years younger than boomers. Right, I was born in 66. Boomers end.
Sounds like something a boomer would say.
It does sound like that. It sounds exactly like something a boomer would say. But it's just like, you know, treating something as, you know, a big conglomerate of opinions as one thing.
Yeah.
You know, I actually was going to do a series of videos of this was probably 5 years ago, where some guys I knew in the crypto industry, younger guys, they were in their 20s. I was in my mid 50s. And they said, we want to do a series where a traditional finance guy gets taught about Bitcoin.
I think we're doing it right now.
I know. Step by step by step.
We should do it.
I said, I am 100% in because I want to know if I believe in this thing or I don't.
Yeah.
And it's okay if I don't.
Yeah.
I just want to know.
I've never met somebody who's learned more about Bitcoin and decided that Bitcoin wasn't for them. Mm-hmm. I've met a lot of people and talked to a lot of people, but never in my entire life.
Have you talked to Mike Green yet?
I have not.
Okay.
But I have.
Try that.
I will try. I'm happy to talk to him.
Try that.
But I have never met somebody that I've talked to about Bitcoin that after our conversation, the more that they've learned, they've decided, no, this isn't for me.
Yeah.
It's been the opposite every single time. Mm-hmm. Right. So, yeah, I mean, if you want to, I don't know what chart this is on CoinDesk.
So it's less than it was yesterday. I'm just remembering yesterday's price.
Can you, let's see, can you pull up CoinGecko, Paul? Because it just shows the percent since inception. I think it's a powerful, it's a striking image to see an asset that's gone up millions of percent.
Between you and me, I've seen it, but maybe the audience wants to see it. So if there's a way to put it up. You know, it was for me, as soon as I heard people saying there is no other way, it's a turnoff for me. You know, because again, let me use the Bernie Madoff example. And I am not saying it's a Ponzi scheme. I'll stress that for everybody. Jesus Christ, calm down. It was this thing where I actually had the unfortunate pleasure of meeting someone who was invested in Bernie Madoff when I was at my fund.
Oh, really?
Right. And she just so happened, it was an older woman, she just so happened to be in the office of a capital allocator who was thinking about giving us money. And she was removing the rest of her money from his fund to put it in Bernie Madoff, right?
Oh, man.
And she was just saying, oh, he just does 1.5% a year. He's always up, or 1.5% a month. Oh, he's always up 12, 13% a year without fail. He's just great. He's this. Now, human, liar, criminal, fraud, completely different than cryptography and math, right? But she had the belief that there was no way that there was any better investment than this. I have a second story. In Chicago, late 90s, guy comes up to me. I had a team of guys that were selling different products. And this guy comes up to me and he says, I want you to sell my principal guaranteed bond. And I said, I'll look at it. So what do you mean guaranteed though? There's no such thing as principal guaranteed. You guys would argue that if you put it in Bitcoin, it is guaranteed. But
well, you're guaranteed to have your Bitcoin, right?
Guaranteed to have your Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, you're not going to guarantee on what the value of its coin would be, right? Yeah, I mean, it's like buying a bar of gold. I mean, one bar of gold is one bar of gold if it's real gold.
And digressing, it's the same thing with gold. Like digressing, you know, unless there's products that are priced in Bitcoin, you never really know what it's worth because fiat is crap. We both agree on that. But back to the story, he said it's principal guaranteed. I said, that's not possible. What do you mean? He said, well, either you get your principal back or you made anywhere from 8 to 16%. I said, well, who guarantees the principal? He goes, Lehman Brothers. I said, okay, that's not principal guaranteed. He goes, well, Lehman Brothers isn't going out of business. Now, again, it's not a company like Lehman Brothers. It's not a person like Bernie Madoff. It's math. It's cryptography.
That's what it is, yeah.
I get it. But what we're not seeing is what we're not seeing. We don't know what we don't know about the possible flaws in Bitcoin. And therefore, same as when I traded on the trading floor, I had a certain amount of money in my trading account. Whenever I doubled it, I took it out and kept the other amount in. I tell people all the time, Bitcoin is either going to a million or zero. That's my common stance.
That's a pretty good analysis. I think, you know, I think we're either going to, you know, 50 million or zero. Eventually.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, you know. Fair enough.
But I think it's a lot more likely we're going to, I can promise you we're never going to zero because I've got a bunch of buy orders sitting at around $1. So
wait till those get to 50 cents. See if they still,
I've got even more sitting at like 5 cents. So we're never going to zero. I can promise you that. I know a lot of other Bitcoiners are doing the same thing. Yeah. But you know, I will tell you that, you know, it's, if this is a linear chart, I mean,
yeah, of course,
you know, it's hard to even fathom, you know, an asset that was trading for a fraction of a penny being, you know, worth over $108,000 over a 17-year span, right? So, I mean, you know, fundamentally, under the hood, you know, there's a lot here that people aren't seeing yet. They don't really understand. But as people do understand, I mean, it's, you know, it's like you, I think you have a quote here. I'm gonna quote you. You know what quote's coming, don't you?
Yes.
You know exactly what's coming. Hold on. It's, where is this quote? I have it here somewhere. I saved it for this very moment. Oh, man.
That's so spectacular.
Your quote is, where is it? It's, the market is always right. You're not. So there's my quote for you.
I mean, that's accurate. You know, and that's why, again, I have been involved in Bitcoin in the past, and I probably will be again in the future. But I need two things to happen to be a believer in Bitcoin. Number one, I need the Bitcoin community to stop being such assholes. And now I'm going to get.
I think you're never going to get that.
That's a shame. That's a shame because your move from 108,000 where it is as we're speaking now to a million would be a lot quicker if people in the Bitcoin community were the same as evangelists for Jesus Christ or Allah or anyone else, where they said, look, I know you don't understand. Listen to what I have to say to you.
It's a good message for the Bitcoin community, honestly.
I met a guy named Paul a couple of weeks back at a person named Dan's house. And he was super kind and super willing to talk about everything. And that's the kind of people.
I think when you meet people in real life, that's how it is. I think there's a group of people on X. And I think that's where you're getting a lot of that.
Yeah. I'm not a Peter Schiff gold guy.
You know, I tell Paul too, because he does a lot of media channels. I just tell him, you know, hey, like this is a vocal minority of people. Most Bitcoiners you meet, you come to our Bitcoin meetup, you meet the people. I mean, like you're, you know, they're very welcoming, great people. I've never met a Bitcoiner in real life that I didn't like. You know what I mean? I think it's just, there's trolls online. It's a lot easier to be an asshole online, you know?
Well, hang on. As a Bitcoiner, you've never met a Bitcoiner that you didn't like.
In person, yeah.
Yeah, but you're a Bitcoiner.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you know,
no doubt. I want to come we're in the same town, so I'm going to come to all your
meetings. Yeah, you should, man.
So here's another part that this is the stance of my co-host on my show, The Future's Edge. Mm-hmm. Jimmy Iorio says, no one can prove to me that Satoshi is not the CIA, the IDF, MI6, special services in Russia, and whatever China's secret services, or I'm sorry, intelligence agencies. Mm-hmm. Because no one can prove me that they are not the ones that created it and they haven't built a back door somewhere that no one's seen.
So my counter response to that would be, first off, I don't think that's who it is. I've done a lot of research.
Agreed. Yeah. And actually,
I think
we know us. We sort of know the same person. I don't know who he is, and you probably know that think they know exactly who Satoshi is. You
have to be that person. I do feel that way. Stop. Yeah. But I will say that a lot of the ideas built into Bitcoin, the monetary history, a lot of these different things, these ideas came from different groups of people. Mm-hmm. And particularly this podcast is based on, and I consider myself one of those people who care about privacy, who care about freedom, the cypherpunks, right? So the cypherpunks, we're discussing this project. And if you watch the very first, I think 10 episodes of this podcast, I interviewed Aaron Van Weerdam, who's the chief editor of Bitcoin Mag, and he wrote a book called The Genesis Book. Mm-hmm. And it takes you through the 70 to 80 years of cryptography research, different communities and groups of people that provided input that Satoshi took to create this idea. So I don't think it's an intelligence community, but yet the second point would be that even if it was, it doesn't really matter because Bitcoin is what it is. Yeah. And you know, when you say backdoors and all these different things, I would say, yes, you're right if it was closed source code, but the code is open source. The idea of open source code means that it's available. The code that underlies the system is publicly available. So I think the argument would be it's a technical misunderstanding of your co-host to where he doesn't, and, you know, me either. I don't have a, like, I can't read the code myself personally, but people who are technically literate to do that, and everybody in the world can see an open source the open source code behind the protocol. If you're running your node and doing your stuff, everything is open source. Mm. So this idea of being open source means that you're showing the whole world. So if there's a back door, it's easy to see where the back door is.
So you're saying if the CIA wrote it, they screwed themselves over.
Yeah. Well, they could be even smarter than we realized. They could have realized that if you study the history of fiat currencies, you'd realize that every single fiat currency in history has fucking failed. So the average lifespan of a fiat currency that's, you know, not tethered to a hard asset is roughly 70 years. Yeah. And we're roughly 70 years into this experiment of total detachment from the gold standard. I think we're 55, 60. We're right around that period of time. And the reason it fails is because governments can't be trusted to debase the currency. They always do.
Why do you say that? Because people talk about what government should and shouldn't do. Mm-hmm. Government are people.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of bad people that go into government. Mm-hmm. I remember my political science professor in college, Dr. Cuomo, said to me once, I said, why don't you ever run for office? He goes, the people are smart enough to run the country would never subject themselves to running for office.
You're not wrong.
Yeah. And that's always been one of my things. And I bought my first gold coin in 1986. It was the first issue of the American Eagle. Mm. And I still have it to this day, but I have sold coins. Mm-hmm. You know, when I see a certain amount that's why I say I'm not a gold bug at all. I'm not like my friend Tommy, who has a bunch of gold and silver buried in places. It's a function of, it's an investment like anything else. Mm-hmm. And until things are priced in something other than dollars, or I can pay my taxes, that's really the big mover for Bitcoin to me. Mm-hmm. It goes from 108,000 where it is today to 600,000 in a day. If all of a sudden the government says you can now pay your
I think that's coming in the pipeline. I think it's already happening in a couple of states that are accepting that now. So you're seeing Ohio, I think, is one of them where you can pay your state income tax in Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple other ones as well, but I'm almost positive we will see that eventually.
Yeah. That to me is the trigger. And you know, it's funny because the CME group, where I do a lot of work still to this day, is one of the first ones, in my view, that institutionally accepted Bitcoin by creating a product where you can hedge your Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And when I saw that, I was like, okay, something's happening here.
Yeah, I mean, the writing's on the wall. This is not going to zero. I mean, we're this is being institutionalized.
Well, I'm never going to say that about anything.
Yeah.
You'll never catch me saying nothing's going to zero. Crude oil went below zero. Mm. So, and crude oil is a physical product.
Yeah.
So you'll never catch me saying that it can't go below zero. Now, this has an advantage over crude oil. It doesn't cost anything to store it.
Exactly.
Right? There's an inherent cost.
You can literally store $1 billion of value if you remember your password, your private key, and you can walk across
the name.
So I'm saying, I mean, you can. I mean, I know, you can if you want to. You know, you could literally walk across any border in the world, anywhere in the world, and you could have $1 billion of value stored in your brain, and nobody would even know. Nobody would even know you own the wallet. You know, so it's just this idea of, you know, true bearer asset on the internet is just a fascinating thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I think you're watching the fundamental nature of that play out here. You know, like you said, you know, the market is always right.
Yeah.
You know, and the market's telling us something over 17 years. Now, like you said, there's other assets too, right? Like money is great. Money's important.
Yeah, right. Money's
great. But money's not everything.
Right.
Right. You know, but money is important. It's just not everything. There's other, you know, cool blockchain projects. There's other assets. There's physical commodities. There's stocks and companies that are doing things and creating value. So, you know, I tell everybody that.
So let me ask you a question about the blockchain. Mm. The interview is switched now.
Yeah, it's fine. Go for it. We'll do it.
Why hasn't or has somebody put blockchain technology into real estate? And I mean, I can't stand real estate agents. No offense to anyone downstairs from the studio or anything like that. I just, real estate agents to me, it's like, it's always a buyer's market if you're buying. It's always a seller's market if you're selling. They all brag about how they market your property, and they all do the exact same damn thing. And everybody I know that used to be a bartender, doesn't want to bartend anymore, is now selling real estate. No offense to bartenders. My wife's a bartender. I think it's an amazing job. But blockchain seems to me to be the simplest. Simplest applications would be in real estate. Is it the realtors lobby that's gotten rid of any plans?
It's not. I mean, because you know, what it really was was the SEC previously and the previous administration was basically scaring the shit out of everybody and preventing business and actually doing the opposite of what their mission is, which is to to create the efficient capital formulation and do all these different things. Mm-hmm. Right? They're actually doing actively the opposite. They were being obstructionist. They were regulating by enforcement. But I think people were scared to launch projects and try experiments and to try to do capitalism and try to create value for people. Mm-hmm. But yes, blockchain is an incredibly useful tool for taking a $1 million property, opening up the liquidity of that property and allowing grandma to buy $500 in her favorite apartment complex,
Right.
And then you can use the blockchain to distribute the profits from that. I mean, I'm super passionate and excited about this, if you can't tell.
Yeah.
But like, yes, that is coming. That is a thing. There's, securitized exchanges like T0 doing some of this stuff now, and that will continue to be built out over time. And you will see more products like that because, it just makes sense. I personally believe too, that you're going to see a lot of equities come on chain and be done on blockchains. So that way they trade 24/7, completely transparent. You can see who owns what. You know, there's a lot of benefits there.
Yeah. By the way, as an active investor, I hate 24/7.
You do?
I hate it. Drives me crazy. My average hold time for a trade for myself is 26 days. That's over about 12 years. Mm-hmm. So taking every trade I've ever done, it's about 26 days. Now that doesn't mean I've held things for 6 hours and I've held things for 6 months. Mm-hmm. It depends on the pattern and what's going on with the actual trading.
Are you reading like the charts and stuff when you're making your trades? Like daily charts, weekly charts, hourly candles, 4 hour candles. Like what are you looking at?
I'm 80% technical in price action.
Okay.
That's a number of things. It's mostly candlestick charts, but that's not where I get ideas from. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you an example. When Chipotle had their E. coli scare, right? I drove by the Chipotle in Chicago a day later on my way into the exchange, and I called my partner and I said, we need to buy Chipotle. And he goes, not yet. I'm like, why? He goes, you look at the chart. You're right. 2 weeks later, I didn't look at the chart. I didn't keep looking at it. 2 weeks later, I'm like, okay, we need to buy it. The line is out the door. Nobody's worried about
Nobody
dying.
Cares about
any of
that
shit. Still want burritos, right? No, we can't buy it. We can't. It fell for like 2.5-3 years before we bought it because the chart was telling us that there was more downside to go. And if you think about what a price chart is, that one or any other one we're looking at, it's the mob mentality in the form of a picture.
Yeah.
Okay. And if people are selling it, it doesn't matter. It's going to go down. People say more sellers than buyers or more buyers than sellers. I hate that because that's bullshit. It's more aggressive sellers than buyers or more aggressive buyers than sellers, right? It's not it's always 1-to-1. So when you're looking at a chart and you're not seeing a bottoming pattern, you're not mm-hmm. seeing a recovery, my plan is always, if something moves from here to here, I want to buy it here and sell it here.
I'm going to get the middle.
I'm taking a section of a move. The analogy I always use is, if I go into a restaurant, I only take my own leftovers home. Mm-hmm. So if a trade happens and I'm not involved, no problem. It wasn't my trade, right? I do my trades and that's it. So I have a thesis for something. And I say, okay, I'm going to look at the chart and see when I can express that opinion in the market. Mm-hmm. And if the chart tells me not yet, I wait. Gotcha. And if I miss it, no big deal. I mean, there's 8,000 stocks being under trade. I can trade. Yeah. So it's not a big deal at all.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's fascinating. What type of things will give you the signal that, hey, the bottom is in here, like a, you know, double bottom or reverse head and shoulders, those types of patterns are you looking
yes,
at?
Yes, we do some of those patterns. Double bottoms are they're very common, mm-hmm. but we've actually researched the hell out of them mm-hmm. and we have found a specific set of rules. For example, uh-huh. I can just throw one out. The left-hand bottom and the right-hand bottom have to be within 25% of each other in price, up mm-hmm. or down.
Okay.
If they're short of that or they exceed that, the probability of it actually reaching a measured move target drops way down. Mm. It goes from about 67% to about 51%. Now, the probability of it actually trending in the direction you're predicting stays high. Mm-hmm. But the measured move target is important because with a win rate, my win rate over that same 12 years is about just under 62%. So I never take a trade unless it's at least 1-to-1 reward to risk. Mm-hmm. So I want that 1-to-1. And if I don't have a high probability that it's going to get to the target that I've measured, mm-hmm. I'm not going to take it.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, because I have no idea when the 48% of the time I'm going to lose money is going to happen. Mm-hmm. I haven't been able to figure that out, otherwise my win rate would be higher. Mm. Our newsletter has a 73% win rate. Mm-hmm. The reason is because we only buy stocks in that newsletter, and stocks have a natural upward bias. Good or bad, they just do. You know, money goes into a long-only mutual fund, and that mutual fund buys stocks regardless of where the price is. So it is patterns, but there's also price action signals as to when things are bottoming. It's a combination of things that I could probably go into, but might take a little time to explain and probably wouldn't really translate to somebody listening to this. Mm. But you could take a pair of moving averages, set them up in such a way that they show you a rotation zone. So if something bottoms, goes back, starts to rally from that bottom, then mm-hmm. pulls back into that rotation zone and then rallies again, the high probability it's going to extend. Mm. I'm actually seeing one right there on the Bitcoin chart, to be honest.
What are you looking at?
It's I'm going to say it's late 2024. Uh-huh. So if that chart were—
Can you zoom in, Paul?
Yeah, if that were zoomed in—
You can kind of, I think you can like zoom into the period he wants, 2024.
I think you drag the date down, Paul. If you go down into the date axis,
you're at 2019.
Pull that. Yeah. That's all right. If you look about where 2024 is, you see a dip in price, right?
Can you pull that in?
Oh, there we go. Nice. So
just click on the chart. The chart should allow you to do it. Click the chart right there. Just click right there. Click right there, Paul. Okay, and drag. To the right. There you go. Keep going.
Keep going all the way to the end. Keep going all the way to the end.
There you go, right there. Yep.
So the funny thing on the left-hand side of the chart—
So scroll down now.
On the left-hand side of that chart is a double top, right? Which came close to reaching— which came close to reaching its measured move target, although I haven't measured it. I'm just visually seeing that it fell just short of it. But if you look at that area of time, say, let's call it mid-2024, okay, you see a gradual move down in the chart and then a spike up, right? What you had was a solid move up in Bitcoin, a solid bullish trend that then pulled back and resumed its bullish trend.
Yeah, like a flag up there.
Yeah. We have a rotation zone that tells us when that's actually triggering to continue the move or when it's reversing and is going to stop the move.
Interesting.
You never know when the high is until the high's put in.
Yeah.
And if you look at like the S&P, for example, the S&P spends about 72% of its time in a drawdown from a high. So it's always falling from a high and then recovering from that high. I want to find that part.
What do you see on the Bitcoin chart right now? What are your thoughts on Bitcoin going forward?
Okay, so Bitcoin is at a really good support level right now. So if I were somebody who bought dips blindly, I'd buy it right now. Mm. I don't buy dips blindly. I wait until dips prove that they're actually a bottom and not just a dip. Mm-hmm. So right now,
so you want to see that zone get tested more.
Yeah.
Than
if right now where it is, we're looking at 108, 197, right? Mm-hmm. If I saw it now move up to about 110, 110.5, it would be a good buy for me.
Mm, interesting.
Just glancing at this chart. I'm not doing a full analysis, obviously.
How about psychological levels? Obviously, like 100K seems like a pretty substantial psychological floor for people.
Psychological levels are real and weak. Mm-hmm. So they actually, you can watch price action respond at those levels. But 100,000 is just 99,999 minus a dollar or plus a dollar. It doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah.
Price action patterns and technical patterns are self-fulfilling prophecies, and so are round numbers, but they're the weakest of the things that we look at. So I'll give you an example. If I bought at 110, right, and say I had a target of 151,000, I'd get out at 149 because I could see some selling at about 150, yeah. And I'm like, okay, I don't need to be greedy. I'll just get out a little ahead of the round number.
Gotcha. Makes sense. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to get out at 148.8. So all you sharks that are getting out at 149, now I know the real psychological.
You're never getting out. We both know that.
No, I'm just going to borrow against my Bitcoin. I'm going to borrow against my assets. So
by the way, nobody's created a good borrowing against your gold program.
Yeah. Yeah. That would
That's one of the interesting things about Bitcoin over gold.
Yeah. We're starting to financialize that in ways.
We have a lot of gold. We have a very large amount of gold in our portfolio at home. Myself and my wife, and I don't want to sell gold and buy a car. Why would you sell
exactly
an asset that's earning money to buy something that's depreciating?
There is that is part of the advantage of having a digital bearer asset, that it's right there. You can see it, you can verify it, you can prove ownership of it with a couple clicks of a button.
And, I could show people enough gold to buy a car.
I mean, yeah,
it was a funny thing. I remember having a conversation with somebody who said, you can't really carry that much gold. And I actually happened to have done something recently too. I bought these little carrying cases for coins, right? I have a lot of coins in the house, and then we have stuff elsewhere. And I had this little carrying case that carried about 10 pieces of gold. And I'm like, well, here's about $19,000 right now. That's not like, are you talking about the end of the world? Because if it's the end of the world, you don't have electricity. Yeah. So what good is Bitcoin?
Well, we can go into that if you want.
I'd like to, actually, but we can finish the thought. But I'm just saying, now it's at the point where that same, 10 coins can now buy me two $20,000. There are no $20,000 cars, but it can buy me one $40,000 car instead of having to carry two of those stacks of coin to buy a $40,000 car. But that's inflation. Mm. I mean, that's the physical manifestation of inflation, that I can, the products are going up in price and I can't do it with those same coins. I have to add another stack of coins to it. Mm. It's annoying.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Oh, interesting. Interesting thought. Yeah. If the end of the world came, I think, food and different things would probably be monetized.
Yeah.
That's
an interesting thing. You go back to like the ancient world and you wonder why gold mattered. Mm-hmm. You look at people your age and younger, and I know a lot of like young people that got engaged without a diamond. They didn't give a shit. They bought a ruby ring with a platinum band or even a sterling silver band. They didn't care about the kind of things that gold are valuable for. Gold's impervious, right? I know somebody who, I told you I lived in the Pacific Palisades in a house that got burned to the ground in the fire. Mm-hmm. Somebody that I still know from out there showed me a bunch of melted but still okay gold, right? Because crypto is digital, your hard wallet may burn, but you still own that money.
Correct. If you have those
keys.
Yeah, you could just regenerate it on it. Exactly. Yeah.
This is one of the fears of somebody like me and people older than me, which we're going to die. So you guys are fine.
Yeah.
I have to write it down. And if that thing burns, I have to write it down 10 different places and I have to keep one somewhere else. And the interesting thing is I used to have an account at Bank of America in the Palisades and they were like sending me emails still to this day, even though I don't bank there anymore, that I'll be able to get into the contents of my burned to the ground safety deposit box soon. And I'm thinking, well, if the whole area where the box is burned is gone, then if I had a paper with my key in there, that's gone too.
Yeah, right? No doubt. Yeah. I mean, you have to think about the custody.
The technology's already taken care of that. Like I've seen a couple of different
There's a couple different ways. Ledger has a product. I'm not a huge fan of it. They kind of take your private keys and they shard it out to three different companies and you can pay for the recovery service. I don't think I think that kind of defeats the purpose
it does.
A lot of ways because you lose some of that.
Now your key is centralized.
Exactly. Well, if a court order comes or whatever, they could subpoena all these different custody services in different countries or whatever, so that there's that threat. There's a threat of that. But I think if you, a little forethought of self, it's like burying gold somewhere, right? You kind of have to remember where you buried it. You have to
you know, write it down somewhere to somebody that you trust. Hey, if I die, you know, it's buried here. It's a very similar thing with Bitcoin, right? Like, you know, I think as long as you don't have, if you have that word or the phrase written, you know, inscribed on metal somewhere, even if it burns, you know, you're fine. If you put it in a metal, if you use a metal,
depending on the metal,
metal storage device. Yeah. Use an expensive one, you know, and one that's not going to burn in a fire, you know, or just get scorched.
You could write it on gold.
Yeah, you could write it on gold. Well, gold will melt. Yeah. So
I got two questions for you.
Yeah.
How do Bitcoin people feel about the evil empire finally getting involved in Bitcoin?
When you say the evil empire,
BlackRock.
Oh, BlackRock. I mean,
evil company to ever exist.
There's a couple different schools of thought, right? So Bitcoiners are not, we all don't share the same opinions. Mm-hmm. My opinion personally is that Bitcoin is for everybody. Mm-hmm. So whether you're an individual, whether you're a family, whether you are a small business, a company, whether you're a big company, a large company, a publicly traded company, whether you're a state, a county, a nation state, mm-hmm. right? I think everybody should have a Bitcoin strategy, right? A Bitcoin, what's the strategic reserve, I guess would be the mm-hmm. way to put it. So I think Bitcoin is for everybody. It's, you know, money that's apolitical. It's neutral. It just, Bitcoin is what it is. You know, just like I can't stop a woman in Nigeria who doesn't have access to a bank account, or a woman in Afghanistan who's not allowed to have a bank account.
Those two women are completely different than BlackRock.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just saying I can't stop them from having it in the same way that I can't stop BlackRock from owning it, in the same way that I can't stop Vladimir Putin from having it on the Russian balance sheet, or anybody else. Right. So I think, and that's part of the value of Bitcoin, is that it's an apolitical money, that, you know, Bitcoin is what it is. Mm-hmm. It is this money. It follows the system, and anybody can use it permissionlessly. So, you know, it's a powerful thing, right? And it's also, some people don't like that, but it's part of the feature of Bitcoin. Just
so
like
you're saying, you don't hate it, you don't like it, you're like, whatever, it's for everybody.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I think Bitcoin, you know, it's money for enemies is the way we put it, right? So I think as geopolitical trends change, I don't think, and you're seeing this right now with all the BRICS stuff, I don't think any government wants to be, at the risk of losing their money, right? Because somebody in political office in another country says, hey, you can't bank, or you did something we don't like, right? So I just think it's, the game theory plays out. You know, gold was money for a long time. We saw how wars kind of affected that when Hitler ran out of gold, how he invaded, tried to steal. I think gold as money, we've seen that through civilizations. The first, you know, when a war occurs, you go and take the gold and you conquer, right? So that's a lot harder to do with Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. So, and this is one of the ideas that really attracted me to Bitcoin, which was this idea of Bitcoin as a tool for peace, because good luck taking the, I mean, if you know where the central bank is and you invade the country, you take all the gold, but good luck taking the country's Bitcoin, right? It's this, you know, money that lives on the internet, mm-hmm. you know, it's this digital bear asset. Mm-hmm. It's a lot harder to take that. So I think there's a different incentive structure for war now going forward. I mean, and I'm talking about game theory of Bitcoin playing out as a tool for different countries and nation states and different things. It's a lot harder to attack something like that.
Is the only way to steal Bitcoin from a large holder? Because that's another one of the things that mm-hmm. people talk about, is how it's a decentralized platform, but mm-hmm. a lot of the Bitcoin is held in a lot of the whales' accounts. And is the only way to take that Bitcoin from them is hold a gun to them and say, send it to me.
Essentially, yeah. I mean, you'd have to do that. But also, like, if you try to take my Bitcoin, I wouldn't even be able to give it to you, because I don't even have, you know, I have strategies set up to make it so I don't even have access to it, right? Yeah. Like, I have access to a small amount of Bitcoin I keep on my phone. So if somebody robs me, okay, you know, you're going to get 10, 20, whatever it is, a little bit of money, mm-hmm. you know, I'll give it to you. But like, there's Bitcoin that I don't have access to. I make sure I don't have access to it, right? It's in cold storage, or it's in a split custody setup.
Sure.
So you can't even get that, you know? So there's different ways to think about it. You can have different buckets of the asset. You can hold it a different way. Just like you can hold physical, you can have a wad of hundreds in your pocket, mm-hmm. but you can also have, you know, a wad of hundreds in your bank account, and you can also have a wad of hundreds under your mattress or in your safe, right? Yeah. So there's just different levels of custody, and you know, as part of the strategy, as you become a Bitcoiner, you do the same thing with gold, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Interesting, right? Am I blowing your brain a little bit? I hope so. A
little bit.
Hope I'm blowing your, I hope I'm blowing your brain.
Yeah.
Oh. I'm going to ask you another question here.
Yeah.
I got to go back to my list.
This part will get cut.
So just heads up. It is 5:43.
Okay.
You said you had a hard stop at...
Yeah, between now and 6. So.
Okay. I'll ask you one more question and we'll just queue it up.
Okay, perfect.
So before we head out here, let me ask you this final question.
Yeah.
You're speaking at the Naples Bitcoin Symposium.
Mm-hmm.
What's drawing you deeper into the crypto world right now? Is it me?
Is that really the question?
Oh,
because I'll say it's you.
I'm partly joking.
Yeah, it's you.
But fine. You know, what do you guys? What's your plan at the Naples Symposium?
Well, I want to be convinced. Honestly, mm-hmm. that's my plan, and I plan to go in there with all the skepticism mm-hmm. and everything negative that I have to say about Bitcoin,
uh-huh.
regardless of how basic the question or the comment may be.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I don't like about Bitcoin, but it's a little bit disingenuous of me because of what mm-hmm. I do for a living,
yeah.
is people are really mostly in Bitcoin for the appreciation. And the reason you see that is because of it still has a huge negative correlation to the NASDAQ, but not necessarily a positive correlation.
Mm.
They move in tandem a lot. They moved in tandem today. Last Friday, again, I don't even know what today's date is, but it's a week after the Friday I'm talking about. Trump threatened more tariffs on China and everything mm-hmm. fell except gold. Gold didn't rally a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't. But over the last 3 years, I've been telling everyone who asked me that I will be all in on Bitcoin when it loses its negative correlation to the NASDAQ, because that tells me that tech investors like Bitcoin and nobody else does. And there's a lot of tech investors. There's a lot. I looked the other day. I think the Bitcoin's correlation to the NASDAQ 100 to the downside is somewhere in the range of positive 70, which is too high.
Mm-hmm.
If Bitcoin's a store of value, shouldn't matter what happens to the NASDAQ.
Yeah, I think,
shouldn't.
I think that we're just still in such an early phase.
Agreed.
I think people don't know so much. There's a quote that's like Bitcoin is one of the greatest inventions in all of humanity, wrapped up as a get rich quick scheme.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Satoshi, the funny part is if you read the Bitcoin talk forums when they mm-hmm. were talking about this, Satoshi actually thought this through. He said, he was literally on the record saying, like, hey, we don't have a marketing budget. We don't have anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, the halving, the way that the inflation rate works and it creates a supply shock in the market, is going to bring in new investors, and some of them will go and some of them will stay.
Mm-hmm.
But that's going to be the marketing department for Bitcoin because we're a decentralized project.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He actually, it's kind of fascinating. It really is. So
no, it is. And I mean, that's why I want to go, and that's mm-hmm. why I want to be there, and that's why I want to uh-huh. be a part of a lot of the discussions. The people at the symposium are going to probably get sick of me raising my hand and go to the microphone when I'm not on the stage.
No, I mean, you know, by all means,
I'm going to go up there and I'm going to be like, look, you guys have to understand something, that mm-hmm. if it's all for the increase of the asset, then you're saying that Bitcoin will get to a final price and it will never move from there. Never. Because with a finite asset, you shouldn't have as many inflation issues as we've had here. We'll obviously still have mm-hmm. economic ebbs and flows.
Yeah.
And the Fed will have to try and find a way to either get involved in those or stay the F out of the way.
Yeah.
I hope it's the latter.
Yeah.
Right?
So that brings me to another question I wanted to ask
Shoot.
You. You know, you, and again, that was supposed to be the last question,
but
this one. You know, you said trading is about personal responsibility,
yep.
hence the mirror on your desk.
Yep.
In a culture built on bailouts and blame, how do we bring accountability back? And one of my good friends, Larry Lepard, I don't know if you know him, but he, like, this is his big anger with, you know, everything that's happened over the past 20, 30 years is like, hey, why are we always bailing out the bad actors?
Man.
You know, this moral hazard that gets created. Why is there no accountability? So I'll punch that one back to you.
I think the generation that everybody puts me in, which is boomers, I'm really X. I want to make that clear. I'm X. God,
something
that's
a boomer
such
would say.
A boomer thing to say. Almost everything negative in the world is the boomers' fault, including the participation trophy, because they're the ones who gave it out.
Oh, man.
Right? And so now we've got this generation of people who I don't think are as tough as they need to be.
You're not wrong.
I'm anti-bailout. Okay? I am. I don't think anyone should be bailed out. But if you're going to bail out a system, this is sort of like, you know, being a heroin addict
mm-hmm.
and now you need methadone.
Yeah.
The bailout is methadone because it didn't fix the problem. And then you gave them back heroin after that by keeping rates at zero for however long, saying inflation was transitory.
ZERP.
How the hell is it transitory if you're still printing money?
I'd love to have you in
quantitative easing.
I'd love to have you and Larry on a podcast
together. Oh my God. But anyway, they did the bailouts. If you're not going to slowly wind things down and say, look, I'd like to see some small failures. You know what would have been a good one? Silicon Valley Bank. Mm. That would have been a great one to let fail.
You know, the crazy part of why I don't think they could let that fail mm-hmm. is the reason they failed was because they bought the pristine collateral of government bonds. Yep. And that's why they went bankrupt.
Well, it's
because they literally bought the government's garbage, these 0% interest bonds that I guess they racked up interest rates. And now those bonds were worth so much less.
Yeah, that's not entirely accurate. And that has to do with the regulatory structure, which I'm also against. Mm. So banks have to hold a certain amount of assets. You know this, mm-hmm. right? Hold to maturity assets. Mm-hmm. And they had a lot of those, right? Mm-hmm. But they could hedge them. They're allowed to hedge them. They didn't hedge them.
Ah.
All they needed was a 5-minute call to my house. And uh-huh. I told them exactly how to hedge them. But instead, they went to DEI picnics. Okay? And that's the actual... There were pictures.
I believe it.
I'm not saying it's one-off, but yeah. There were pictures on their website of them at their DEI picnic day before... their hold to maturity assets, which is mandated in order to prevent what happened in 2007, 2008, 2009. Mm-hmm. They mandated hold to maturity assets, but then you're sitting there going, we can't hike rates. We're going to drown a bunch of banks. So they leave the rates artificially low. It's literally like...
It's like communism in a way. It's like...
When we stop recording, I'm going to say what I was going
to say. Just say what you're going to say.
It's ridiculous what they were doing. So I'm against bailouts entirely.
How do you... But can you explain this more? I want to know a little bit more about... You're talking about they could have hedged this. I mean, why would you hedge supposedly the most safe thing you can possibly buy, which is a government bond?
Because everything that can't go to zero can... Mm.
But so how do you hedge?
Back to what we said or talked about earlier. Just treasury market futures. It takes away a portion of the return, but you have to calculate that in.
So let me ask you a question. If the return is literally less than 1%.
Well, that's the return of the bond. They fluctuate on price versus inflation and other assets. So zero, you don't buy zero coupon bonds at the price of the coupon. Mm-hmm. Okay. Just there's no added benefit there. Mm-hmm. So for example, if you were buying a 10-year bond, today the 10-year went to its lowest yield, I think since April of this past year, it was below 4%. Okay. Your bonds are issued constantly. So there's something called closest to issue, right? And that's where the bond futures are they're priced to closest to expiration or closest to issue. I forget the term. I haven't been down on that trading floor for a long time. Oh, cheapest to deliver. That's what it is. So you're looking at bonds with different maturity levels. So you buy a 10-year bond in the open market. If you're buying it from the government, it's got a 10-year duration. But there's other bonds out there on the secondary market that's a 10-year bond, but it's only got 7.5 years left. So some of those coupons have already been paid and the price is discounted because of that.
Yeah.
Zero coupon bonds, it's not just a guarantee of your principal. Okay, you're buying it at a discount. Mm-hmm. And you're buying those because that spread is locked in. Mm-hmm. So when interest rates go up and regular bonds are paying a heck of a lot more, those become worth very little.
Yeah, exactly.
And so the assets of the bond, which are marked to market, you shouldn't have to... Does everybody know what mark-to-market is?
Probably not.
Okay, so mark-to-market, it means that every single day your assets are marked to their value for that day. If you have an asset that you cannot sell, you have to hold it to maturity, it should not be mark-to-market.
It doesn't matter because you have to hold it to maturity anyway.
You're right. So what is today's marking matter?
It doesn't matter.
It matters is it takes a bank like Silicon Valley Bank's value in terms of the assets they're supposed to hold down below the threshold they're supposed to hold.
Which scares everybody, which sparked the bank run.
This is the crap of the whole monetary system that we're in that you and I have both studied and we know is wrong, right? And you have your solution. I may be buying into your solution. I may not. That's what the Naples Symposium is for me. Mm-hmm. I told somebody the other day, I'm going into the lion's den. I said, why? I said, because I'm going to throw everything I've ever heard of the negative side of Bitcoin and have everybody yell and scream and throw shit at me.
No, it's perfect. It's fine. I love this
podcast. I'll bring the tomatoes.
I think we're doing a great job.
I'll bring the damn tomatoes.
We're having a cool conversation and I'm teaching you things. You're teaching me things. Mm-hmm. We're learning. We're open-minded. I think it's awesome.
I'm having a lot of fun. It's a good place to be.
I guess we'll wrap it here. Bob Iacino, it's been a pleasure, bro.
Absolute pleasure.